Hi, everybody. We're back after a week, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 334. John is missing an episode for the first time since the Castlevania Game Club, and before then, I don't know, 15 years, something like that. But I, Neil Ronahan, I'm with you this week, and joining me is our editor, co-host extraordinaire, Alex DeFreitas.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going all right, you know, hanging in there during Gamescom, getting excited for the the little lull of the onslaught of games coming about. But I believe, Alex, you were like me, where all we're doing is playing Xenoblade when we have time to play video games.
I didn't pay attention at all to Gamescom. I've just kind of peeking at it from the side here the past couple minutes, but I've just been playing Xenoblade mostly.
I'll be honest, from having someone who kind of paid attention to Gamescom, I don't think you're missing that much.
Yeah, from everybody who paid attention to the Jeff Keighley presentation, it didn't seem like there was much there, especially for Switch owners.
And that's going to be par for the course. And it is like with the Keighley stuff, I think I said it in the NWR Slack chat or something like that, about how in Keighley's efforts to take over E3, he became E3, where I feel like with Opening Light Live, which that was the Gamescom event that he had, and the Summer Games Fest kickoff thing back in June, and even the Game Awards, like, they all have a very similar feel and vibe. And we're getting to that point where there's like a list of games that it seems like Keighley just has the exclusive on updates on, like how we keep on seeing the dude who made Dead Space, who's doing Callisto Protocol, which I don't think I will play that game, but that game as a spiritual successor to Dead Space looks great. But it just seems like, oh, like Keighley's buddies with this dude. He shows up at every one of his shows. Cool. Like, it's all like, there's not a lot of surprises because there's a lot of things that like you just expect, like, okay, he's probably going to get Kojima to show up. Maybe I'm going to listen to Kojima's podcast. I don't know. I don't know if you saw that, but yeah, Hideo Kojima is doing a podcast.
I mean, Kojima is having a podcast. Sakurai has a YouTube channel. Like, I'm all here for legendary Japanese game devs having content creation side projects.
I mean, that's honestly the biggest news this week.
Yeah. Oh,
Sakurai,
I'm all in.
Making a YouTube channel. Like, I noticed, like, there, because, Masahiro Sakurai, who you might know as the dude behind Smash Brothers and Kirby and a lot of things, man about town, as it were. But he, like, the other day on Twitter, he's been doing, like, daily Smash Brothers pictures since Ultimate. I think since Ultimate was fully revealed at, E3 2008? I think so. He's been doing that for, like, 4 years.
Yeah. Longstanding tradition.
But yeah, and he said, like, all right, like, this is the last daily Smash Brothers thing I'm going to do, but I think I'm going to do something else, but it's not going to be daily. And I was like, huh, I wonder what, like, maybe it's, like, an announcement for a next project's going to happen, and then he's going to do, like, a monthly, like, blog thing like he did with, like, the Smash Dojo or something. Like who knows? Mm-hmm. I didn't expect it to be, like, Sakurai seems like he's about to open up a Patreon and go out alone. Yeah. Even though he kind of did that like 20 years ago when he left HAL Labs, and I think he's been doing a pretty good job for himself going it alone. Although most of it has been making games for Nintendo, outside of like his brief media dalliance.
He also made that Beetle game, which I just found out about.
Yeah, yeah. Like, there's
never
a lot
heard
of
that
weird
before.
Yeah, so he's only got 3 videos on his channel so far. One of them's like I do love him kind of bagging on the YouTube algorithm.
Yes.
But also
some of
like
my favorite parts,
near and dear to my heart, where he's like, I know I can make long videos and like that would be very good, but I'm gonna try to keep these as short and to the point as possible. Like, out of the 3 videos that he put out, I mean, one of them is just like, it's basically like a slideshow of all the games that he directed, and one of them's a 7-minute long intro video, and then the other one's like a 4-minute video that I actually have not watched, his the one of Substance that he's had out.
It's pretty good
about hit stops, but I love that this is happening, and it is the kind of thing, like, part of the reason why I haven't watched that video is because I wanted to like sit down and really pay attention to it, whereas I watched his intro video on my phone before I went to bed, because that's when that all happened.
Yeah, there's just something very heartwarming to like see this legendary developer who's been in the industry for so long. Like, keep in mind, he made Kirby when he was 19 years old. he's in his early 50s and he still is so passionate about game design that he is self-funding this project. Like, he doesn't need to do this. It's not like this is going to build any clout for him. He doesn't need this to get jobs.
He's not monetizing the videos, which that's one of those things where it's very silly that, like, especially if it is something like you're, you know, paying for editors and stuff. Mm-hmm. I've seen a couple of, like, I'll say this not to slag on NoClip, Danny O'Dwyer, who used to be at GameSpot. The documentaries that NoClip puts together are phenomenal, but he, like, you know, they're funded by Patreon and he won't do monetization on YouTube videos, and it seems like they have funding issues. And I look at that, I'm like, bro, just turn on the monetization for YouTube. Come on, man. And, like, that's what, like, I do see Sacrifice thing where it's like, you can make these monetized and it'll just be a way for you to generate some income, not necessarily for you to, like, you know, have this huge ROI, but just, like, fund what you're doing.
Right, just to pay for the costs.
Keep the lights on of editors and your giant couch.
I do wonder if, like, after all those Smash Brothers videos, and I think, like, didn't those Smash Brothers videos where he's the one kind of leading them, were a product of them running out of marketing money?
That is what he said. I mean, there's some, it is also funny, the ones that are like pre-pandemic where you'd have all like the people in the office laughing.
Yes.
Definitely a different tenor when it was like in his house. But I think that was a little, like, that's what they said, is that it was, they ran out of marketing money, which is probably true. It's also like, what's the best way to communicate this? It's that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. I wonder if the content creation bug bit him when he was making those. He was like, I want to do this for game design now.
Yeah, I mean, thinking of how in the weeds those Smash character breakdowns would go and how long they all were. Yeah, no, he probably had fun with it. And it's probably something where he might have had questions arise and that kind of led to this. Like, I mean, he does reference in his intro video talking about how, like, people want him to give talks or teach them, and he's like, this is my attempt at doing that. And I think probably a thing with Sakurai too is that the fact that he did go it alone, for people that don't know his history, he actually technically never really worked for Nintendo. I don't think he's ever been a full-time salaried Nintendo employee, because he was at HAL Labs.
Right.
That's where he made Kirby, and I think Nintendo has an ownership stake in HAL Labs, but they are not a subsidiary. HAL Labs is a separately owned company. It's kind of like a Pokemon company. Like, Game Freak, I think, isn't owned by Nintendo as well. There's a handful of companies that are in this spot, where Intelligent Systems is another good example of a company that is not owned by Nintendo but is very Nintendo friendly, and Nintendo usually has some amount of ownership stake in the company. But Sakurai started at HAL Labs, made Kirby, and then he was there, I guess, about like 10, 15 years, something like that. Because his last game was Kirby Air Ride, which came out on GameCube in like 2002 or 2003. And then he was an independent contractor. That's what he made Meteos. I think, did he do that with Q Games? Or was it Q Entertainment? I need to double check this.
I know nothing about Meteos.
It's a really good puzzle game. I do, that and Luminous came out at the same time, which is why I'm getting it confused with, it was Q Entertainment. Oh, that's weird. because it came out around the same time as Luminous, which was a Q Entertainment game. Tetsuya Mizuguchi, who you probably have heard of, he did Rez, and also Tetris Effect. But now Tetris Effect,
very good game.
Yeah, what is this new? Yeah, Enhance is the company that he has now, that he's had that company since 2014. But Q Entertainment was the predecessor there. He's also, Mizuguchi's an old Sega guy, did like Space Channel 5, and that's where he did Rez. But yeah, he did Luminous, which is a pretty like cool puzzle game, and then worked with Sakurai on Meteos, which is a pretty cool puzzle game. I just remember always getting them confused. But then that's when Sakurai, you know, struck out on his own and then wound up just working with Nintendo as an independent contractor, first on Brawl, where there's definitely some Smash Brothers heads Smash Brothers heads who definitely have more of this history off the top of the dome, whereas for me, it's a little rusty. I know with Brawl, he worked with Game Arts, and I think that was a rough development process. And then for Kid Icarus Uprising, he put together a specific team just for that game. And that apparently was hell, because like when you're working with an established developer, everybody has worked together. Like you see that it's easier. And that's part of the reason I think Kid Icarus Uprising was, I think, a longer development cycle and also a pretty hard one. And that was because that team was put together specifically for that game. And I think after that game was done, that team disbanded. But then for the past decade, he's been working with Bandai Namco.
Right.
On the Smash Brothers games. And so, I mean, it's a weird thing because it's, I think technically with Smash Brothers, like there's not a lot of people who work directly at Nintendo. There's definitely a producer or two and stuff like that. But it's Bandai Namco doing a lot of the heavy lifting. And Sakurai, who is not a Nintendo employee, he's directing it.
Yeah, I guess that kind of explains why Kid Icarus Uprising hasn't had like a sequel or a remaster of any sort.
Hey, dude's got time now.
Well, yeah, I guess he's going to have to create a new team.
Well, that just, I mean, he's been working with Bandai Namco since 2012. Bandai Namco
do it?
Yeah, get Bandai Namco on Kid Icarus Uprising 2.
I trust them with Smash Brothers. I guess I'll trust them with Kid Icarus Uprising.
Bandai Namco is one of those companies that have, like, them and Koei Tecmo are like 65% of Nintendo's games.
It feels like it, right?
Because Bandai Namco, if you believe the rumors, and the rumors were true, they were working on Metroid Prime 4 initially. And Mario Kart, that's Bandai Namco's worked on 8.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought that was all internal.
I believe with 8, I think I actually looked this up recently. I believe with 8, it was mostly asset generation. Mm-hmm. And that was part of... That's part of why Nintendo went to the development structure that they're currently in, is because there's like the three. I'm actually I'll mention it on the show so that way people can bug me when it's not done in 6 months. I'm slowly working on a very long video script about like Nintendo's development history and like the different groups and stuff over the years. But so there were like the research and development groups. That's if you've ever heard like R&D 1, R&D 3. That's where that comes from, where R&D 1 was Gunpei Yokoi. I think, what was it, R&D 3 or 4, that was Miyamoto's team, that then became EAD, Entertainment Analysis and Development.
Then we got SPD.
Yeah, and then SPD. So SPD, that comes into play in 2003, 2004, when Iwata becomes president, where he realigned everything. And that's also a big reason why... like Metroid, 2D Metroid went away for a while, is because R&D 1 historically made the Metroid games. Mm-hmm. They then became SPD, which is Software Production Department or something like that. But SPD was not an internal development team. It was an internal production team. So all the SPD would be working with other developers outside of Nintendo on games.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, for Metroid, at SPD, it's why Other M was with Team Ninja. It's why Samus Returns and Dread are with Mercury Steam, because they don't really have... There are developers... there are developers from Nintendo. Like, for those Metroid games, I believe there is a Nintendo director, but they just don't have the fullness of the staff to do that. And then I think it was after Iwata's death was when they went into their new structure, which is basically there's less walls. There are still teams... but more of like the asset generation is shared between them, whereas before they were more siloed. Mm. And that's even, there's like the stuff recently where I think Game Freak is now based out of the same building as Nintendo. I think there's some
were
stuff
they not like that before.
No, Game Freak was in a separate building, but now
because HAL also in the same building as Nintendo?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I forget. I think there's all of internal Nintendo outside of the EAD Tokyo, or I guess they're technically EPD Tokyo.
Yeah.
Because that is the new name is EPD, because it's basically EAD and SPD being combined is now it's one unit as opposed to separate ones with individual teams between them. But yeah, Nintendo moved to a new development space sometime in the past couple of years. That stuff, it's more like I remember when the news got announced. I haven't dug into the modern stuff as much for this video yet.
Well, did you hear that they're also restructuring again?
For what?
Wasn't there like a fire at the office or something?
Oh, yeah.
It's a different kind of restructuring. Yeah, they buy new furniture.
I was just like, what did I miss? It's the Switch Pro is too powerful.
Way too powerful. The DLSS 4K.
It doesn't work. It's black magic.
No, but I get what you're saying. Like, it's also the reason we don't have the Wario Land games anymore. Is that used to also be, I think it was also R&D one, those Goomba you play.
Yeah.
And then that went to Good Feel and Treasure for Wario and Shaken and Wild World.
Suzak, I think, did a shitty Wario game, or I forget.
Masters in Disguise.
I think that was Suzak.
Master of Disguise.
Yeah. But there is, I mean, you can tell that where there's like they need the partner for it. They can't just do it on their own. And there's like a lot of quotes from Yoshio Sakamoto, the 2D Metroid guy, the father of Metroid, where he's just like, oh, I was looking for the right developer and I couldn't find it. Like that was his reasoning for why there wasn't. Oh, I mean, the wild thing about that is that some of those issues crop up before the 2004 restructuring, because Sakamoto talked about how they didn't have the right team to make a Metroid game on N64. And I think that's why as games got more complicated, Nintendo's never been a company, you know, whether they should do this or not, they haven't been a company to just ramp up staffing just to do one game. Like they like keeping it a little leaner, which is why they do a lot of outsourcing, bring in a lot of, you know, contract teams. And I think an example of like how Kid Icarus Uprising's development, where that was a lot of contractors brought together to make a team. I'd love Kid Icarus Uprising very much. I think that game rules, but I think the development for that was very, very tough. And that's probably a lot more why you see Nintendo not building like contractor teams for specific games, and as opposed to we are going to partner with this developer that is already organized together.
And somehow they're still able to maintain like that Nintendo level of polish, even when they're working with these third parties that maybe in the past, you know, like the classic ones, Mercury Steam, where Castlevania Lords of Shadow isn't exactly highly regarded, but Metroid Dread is absolutely stellar. And I still think Samus Returns is really good too.
Yeah, I mean that's a testament to the producers. Like that's what I've had conversations with different Western studios that have worked with Nintendo. I forget who exactly what I can or cannot talk about. One of them was Nspace. They don't exist anymore, so I think I can talk about that. But like a lot of those Western developers, whenever I've talked to anybody from them, it's always that like those producers, it's very tough. Like, I mean, with the game that Nspace did with Nintendo, Geist, like a 2005 first-person shooter on GameCube, I think there's a lot of horror stories of working with Miyamoto just because he was very demanding. But I do think that, I mean, even if Geist is a game that, maybe that's like a C-level game, B-level at best, for its time, maybe, a B game. But like, there's a lot of things that it's demanding, but if you can work with those Nintendo producers, you're working with some of like the top video game talent in the world.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think Miyamoto lost his fastball a little bit, but he's still really stinking smart and knows a lot of things about this industry that people like make Miyamoto make a YouTube channel.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure his intuition's still there. He makes weird decisions sometimes, but still a genius in my eyes.
Yeah,
I do wonder, like, what if you were to take all the games that were made specifically by NCL, internally developed EAD, how many games get produced by Nintendo a year versus everything that gets outsourced?
It's probably depressingly low.
Yeah, like there's probably years where like Nintendo doesn't put out anything themselves.
Yeah, like I think I actually remember looking at that at some point, and now I'm bringing it up. I mean, 2020, special circumstances. guess how many games were internally made by Nintendo?
2020 specifically?
Yes.
I'm going to say maybe Pikmin 3 Deluxe was?
Actually, no. No? No? Pikmin 3 Deluxe was, I think it was aiding. They're like, they did like a DS, a 3DS eShop game with Nintendo. I forget what I think they've done worked on fighting games, but like they did a lot of the port work on Pikmin 3 Deluxe.
Okay, so not them. Origami King was Intelligent Systems.
Yep.
Xenoblade Definitive Edition, was that 2021 or was that 2020?
Well, regardless, I mean, I guess it depends on what we count as internal. Because Xenoblade Definitive Edition was Monolith, but they are wholly owned. But if we're talking about Nintendo EPD,
yeah,
like what games out of there? Well, here I will give you the number and see if you can guess the games. 2023 games.
Three games.
At least according to this Wikipedia page that I think is right, but there might be one that's not here that should be here.
Let me take a look at Nintendo 2020. Okay, so New Horizons, that's got to be it. Yep,
New Horizons is one of them.
Super Mario 3D All-Stars, was that
them? That's two.
That's horrible if that's like a third of their output for that year.
Just wait until they get to the third game. It's not better than that.
Not Pikmin 3 Deluxe?
It is a free download-only game.
I'm trying to think. Mario 35?
Jump Rope Challenge.
Jump Rope Challenge?
I think Mario 35 was Eureka, I think. I know they did. I think Eureka did Tetris 99 at least.
Yeah, no, I believe you. When you said download-only game, I thought, gotta be maybe Mario.
I mean, it's not even actually, like, look at it. This is hilarious. 2021, what the hell? What a big year. Five whole games.
Wow.
Because even like I'm looking at this, I mean, 2017 was a hell of a year. I mean, that's because a lot of that's probably just because the launch year games, they had a lot of time to plan for that.
Well, there's a lot of like drought years ahead of that year in order to make up for it. Like,
yeah,
2015 and 2016 were atrocious.
Although even 2016 has a good amount of games. Like the list for 2016, although some of the, yeah, this is where I get into whether or not this Wikipedia list is accurate, because Twilight Princess HD is there, but that was
Tantalus, right?
Yeah, that was done by Tantalus. Miitomo, Star Fox Zero and Guard, which was done with Platinum Games.
Yeah.
But I do think that was a case where I believe Platinum was doing more asset generation than anything else. Miitopia, which I think the 3DS game was internal, and then the Switch port was done by Grezzo. Mario Maker 3DS, Super Mario Run, Tank Troopers, which that was another one that was done by Vitae. Yeah, I don't totally trust this list, but yeah, I mean, like, just going over internally what are the two internally developed games that we know about in 2022? There are only two. So I mean, it's just basically like there could be something announced that comes out at the end of the year. So it's not a definitive list, but that one of them is out, one of them is not.
Okay. Shoot. This list isn't helpful. Because everything I'm looking at here is like Xenoblade 3, that's Monolith. Switch Sports.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then there's one other one.
That is not out yet.
Can you give me a month of when it's going to come out? Is it September?
Yes.
Splatoon 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. This is a sobering game. And then I almost want to, like, I feel like there's the comparison to see, like, how many Koei Tecmo games came out. Because we definitely
are. Koei Tecmo versus EPD.
Like, yeah. Koei Tecmo, I mean, already has three hopes, and that's without me thinking any harder.
I mean, just like Square Enix Switch exclusives, that's a Triangle Strategy. What's the other one? Live Alive and Harvestella. Is Harvestella coming to other consoles?
Harvestella, I don't think, is Nintendo published.
Okay.
Although I forget, I think that's Switch exclusive. Yeah, just like
they're getting a Treehouse. Okay.
I think it is a Switch console exclusive, but I believe Square Enix is publishing that.
Okay, it does say platforms Nintendo Switch and Microsoft Windows. So
So it's a console exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, looking at the list of other games out this year, EPD might win the day. Technically they're tied with Square Enix, because Triangle Strategy and Live Alive.
Yeah.
But Three Hopes is Koei Tecmo.
Going back to 2020, who made the classic games, 50 classic games, or Clubhouse games?
That might have been, I think that might have been done by another company, but that could have been internal. ND Cube.
Okay.
Yeah. Mario Party fellas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they also did Wii Party.
Yeah, Wii Party's great. That's one of my, I think until Superstars, Wii Party was my favorite party game of the past like 10 to 15 years.
Oh, there was a Wii Party U. I didn't even realize that.
No, Wii Party. We actually no. Specifically, Wii Party U is my favorite favorite Wii Party. Yeah, Mario Kart Live was Velen. it's really sobering looking at that sometimes. And it's
yeah.
I mean, some of that's the nature of game development, and it's not like Nintendo's not doing anything. There's a lot of support, and it allows for them to have that more iteration.
No, I agree. I think it's a smart strategy for a company like Nintendo, which is like, if you consider them as part of the big three video game console makers, like they're a pretty small company. So this is a good way for them to compete and not have too long of a drought. But yeah, it is sobering. It is very sobering, especially when you consider that the sequel to Breath of the Wild has probably the longest development time of any 3D Zelda game at this point.
Yeah, because I mean, let's say it started development in 2018, because they finished the DLC at the end of 2017. So we're looking at it'll be approximately 5 years, whereas Ocarina of Time definitely did not have that long of a development. Well, I mean, Ocarina of Time has the gap, but I don't think it started development until like 95 or something, 94 maybe.
Yeah, I mean, Miyamoto couldn't have been working on that game in Mario 64 at the exact same time.
Yeah, like that's one of those weird things where like because it's like shared technology.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, Wind Waker, Majora's Mask, those were both a couple years. Twilight Princess, even with that quote unquote big gap, that's 4 years between Japanese release and because it came out at the end of 2002, and then Twilight Princess was 2006. Skyward Sword, there was a big gap. So Breath of the Wild 2 is kind of hitting up against the Skyward Sword line, but that was another game where I don't know if that necessarily was like in development, January 2007. It's always weird because you don't know what kind of iteration they went. And it seems like with Skyward Sword, they probably didn't settle on some of those specific motions until Wii Sports Resort and Wii Motion Plus.
But if we're talking about like just the raw amount of time between each release.
Yeah.
This has been the longest.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It will be by the time it comes out. Well, Breath of the Wild after Skyward Sword, because Skyward Sword was 5.5 years.
And then this was November 11th,
2011, and then March 2017.
Yeah,
so
it's a little under 6 years.
Yeah,
a little over five years, really.
Yeah, and then I mean, if whatchamacallit? Well, I guess yeah. God, 6 years since Skyward Sword. That's like at best case scenario is 6 years after Breath of the Wild. We'll get the next Zelda game.
Yep.
And hey, maybe 6 years after Mario Odyssey, we'll get a new 3D Mario.
Maybe 10 years after Mario Kart 8, we'll get a new Mario Kart.
they're doing well. Like they don't need to rush. It's a good spot to be in for them.
Is Tour internally developed?
That's another one where Bandai Namco helps out a lot. But Tour, the director of Tour is Kosuke Ibuki, who is the director of 8. And also the director of ARMS.
That's right. But
as far as I know with Tor, and I don't know if this is like crystal clear, I think Bandai Namco is doing development on a lot of like the day to day stuff. I think, but I'm not totally sure. But like I know, like I don't think the internal team working on Tor has necessarily fully moved on from Tor. Like I think they're still involved. It's just that I think the new courses might be done by Nintendo, but I think the day-to-day stuff might be by more of like a steady team as opposed to like the big shots.
All I'm saying is that if this was EPD World Report, we would only be active like 3 or 4 times a year.
Be very slow days.
Yeah.
One game not coming out as we're now a half an hour in, and I guess we kind of talked about Sakurai's YouTube channel and then a bunch of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to our second topic, which is Kirby's Dream Buffet, which is a game made by I forgot to check to see if anybody else other than the HAL Labs is working on it, because I think like Vanpool has worked on some of the other Kirby eShop games, but I have not checked that out. people write in about who developed this game, because I did not do my homework on that one. But I have been playing Kirby's Dream Buffet, and it's gonna sound like I'm dragging it, which maybe I am. It's a pretty dumb game that is really fun to play with a 4-year-old.
That seems to be like the ideal situation to play that game.
Yeah, like it clicked with me where I downloaded this game. I was part of the reason why we didn't record last week was I was away on vacation. And I had this game, I preloaded it and stuff, so that way, you know, I'd just be able to connect to, you know, hotel Wi-Fi and then just be able to play it when it came out. And I was like, all right, I'll boot it up, make sure kind of just get it, so that way if my son wants to play, we can just hop in and play. And I did around. I did it locally because the Wi-Fi at the hotel was not good enough to do. I tried. It did not work.
Does it allow for two players, or was it like?
Yeah. So there is. It is. CPU. It is. You can do local on two player split screen.
Okay.
But I played through a run, and I'm like, okay, this is kind of dumb, but it's enjoyable. You're doing these races, then there's some mini games. It's cute. And I got bored with it after I did it twice, and I was like, I don't, maybe this is bad. And then I played it with my son, and he had a ball. wound up just we did some two player, and he had fun with that. And then he was just playing it by himself. And I think he won once, but he just giggled and laughed and collected fruit and, you know, used the different power ups on the other Kirbys that he was fighting against. And it seems like it succeeds as being that here, play with this toy. There's a lot of stuff to unlock. You can, you know, deck out your Kirby. There's different mini games that unlock. It's very cute. It's just that coming off of Forgotten Land, if you played Forgotten Land as an adult, a lot of us did, and you're like, all right, let's go, new Kirby game. You're going to play Dream Buffet and probably be like, what happened? Forgotten Land was brilliant. This is okay, I guess. And I don't I struggle to call Kirby's Dream Buffet bad, but it's definitely not something that I would say everybody needs to go out and play.
It's definitely $15.
Yeah. And there's 100 levels to go through as far as unlocking stuff. And a lot of them are cosmetic. But I've talked to other, you know, gamer dads who have been playing this with their kids, and they're all having a blast. The fact that it has, it's the kind of weird thing where it has free to play mechanics, but it's not a free to play game. So it has that idea of like the way you level up and unlock stuff, it's kind of like a battle pass, but it's a $15 game where you don't need to pay any more money. It has an online mode that, yes, you need to have an online subscription and stuff, but it's not like there's a pay to win model there. There's a play to win. Although even that, I don't think, it's not like any of the cosmetics give you more powers. It's just, you look different. Kirby has a burger hat.
I like that.
But and it's super cute. It looks nice.
Do you unlock just cosmetic stuff, or are there also, because you said you unlock mini games as well?
Yes. So there is basically, the way it works is that there's three mode. There's kind of a standard race, I believe, where it'll just be four Kirbys racing. And if you're doing any kind of four player thing, if you're playing it online, it'll be four Kirbys racing, and you want to collect fruit. The first one to get to the finish line will get an extra bonus of fruit. Those are, I don't think they're truly procedurally generated. I think it kind of rotates between a number of designs. Then the second round will be a mini game. And the mini games, they're usually, it's some of it's just not there's fruit that's going to fall, collect the fruit. But those you do unlock as you play. And it doesn't, I'm only at level 15 or 20. So I still have a long way to go to see what all the unlocks are. And it only shows you the next 5 to 10 unlocks ahead of you. And so it's basically that'll be randomly selected. You can play all these mini games just separately, like a Mario Party game where, you know, you can just go play a mini game, just the mini game by itself if you wanted to.
Right.
Then there is a third race that if you saw the trailer, where there's just a shitload of Waddle Dee. That's this one is it's the bigger race. And then there's a final battle royale, which I like that they use that terminology, where that's when it's like you're knocking the other Kirbys off of, like, you're basically, it's a Kirby ball fight. And then that's like when you knock a Kirby off, you get some of their fruit or they drop their fruit. And then the one with the most fruit at the end wins. The fattest Kirby wins the day.
And all four participants play in all four of I guess four or five rounds. Yeah.
Which I have not, as of recording, I have not played this online yet. I've just played it locally.
Is there like a ranking system or some sort of way to keep you engaged in the online? Or is it just, hey, play a match?
I believe there is a player rank, like a lot of Nintendo games use this, where it's basically like you start with like a score like 1500.
Yeah.
And if you lose a lot, you'll go down. If you win a lot, you'll go higher.
Global Smash Power.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something like that.
Cool. Should I bully the stream team into playing this game?
Let me double check if you can do a match with friends.
Ooh. That sounds like a bad question to hear.
I think you can.
Okay.
I think you can, but I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to go on and check out for myself. If I can, then yes, I would bully people to do that.
Cool.
It
does look cute.
The one thing that I'll point out that did not bother me, but one of my game, actually, former connectivity host Nathan Mustafa, I was talking to him about, he was playing it with his daughter, that the second player, when you're doing local two player, the first player can customize the look of their Kirby all they want. Second player cannot.
Mm.
So that's good. That's disappointing.
Do they have limited options or like no options?
I think they can change colors and that's it. Whereas if you, the first player unlocks more colors, and then also like Kirby can have a burger on his head.
It's important for my Kirby to have a burger on its head.
Yeah, Kirby. So
there are more colors than just the traditional four that we typically see Kirby in.
One of them is burger brown.
Burger brown.
Yep.
That's awesome.
But it is what it is. It's a cute little game. I'm not going to be at the top of my game of the year list, but definitely I might play it more than I did Mario Strikers. That's something.
I put like 40 hours in Mario Strikers.
I'm curious. Are you still playing Mario Strikers?
No, I'm not. Okay. I played maybe a couple extra hours once they had that announcement with Daisy and Shy Guy. I'll probably go back again. But yeah, I feel like I devoured that game for a couple of weeks, and I'll return to it on occasion. But
yeah, I think I wound up putting like 5 to 10 hours into it, which I mean, I bag on it a little bit more because I think there's things that are lacking in that game. I wish I wanted to play it more. I just don't see a lot of reason outside of when my kids like, yo, let's play Mario Soccer. Because I did actually boot it up and played some games with Daisy and Shy Guy. Starting to get my strats for how I would build up Shy Guy and Daisy if there was really any reason to engage further with that online mode.
Yeah, and I am still upset that there's no four player on one team online. Yeah. Like that it's really kind of kills it for me.
Yep. Like I feel like there was a lot more potential with that game and they just fell short across the board, whether it's the online experience or the offline experience.
Yep, I won't deny it. I really like that game's mechanics, but it's missing some stuff for sure.
And from a pick up and play perspective, although I mean it'd be not that this is really, I think it's maybe a problem with every Mario Strikers game, is that there's I tried playing it with a friend of mine who it's impossible. Like there's so many fiddly parts of it that it does not work as a pick up and play multiplayer. And like, so once again, like there's another thing where it kind of kills it a little bit. The fundamentals are really good. It's just a lot of the other things are rough.
Yeah, it requires skill, which is both what I love about it and also makes it kind of awful to, like, in a party setting where you just want to play a bunch with your friends who may have just picked it up for the first time. Like,
yeah,
they won't be able to really even hold a candle to you if you're playing in a versus capacity.
All right, so that's Kirby's Dream Buffet. As we mentioned at the start of the show, Gamescom is going on. You were in a Xenoblade Chronicles 3 hole, which is a great place to go. That game's very good.
It's fantastic. I don't want to leave.
Is there anything from Gamescom that caught your fancy?
Sonic Frontiers still looks bad.
So I accept my fate, going back to why I'm probably going to play more Dream Buffet than anything else. I just accept my fate that I'm going to play a lot of Sonic Frontiers because of my child, who I think I've seen the Sonic the Hedgehog movie twice this week so far.
Still?
Yes. Well, there was a long gap, and then he got back on it. I think partially because I did have, like, I found, like, a cheap Sonic toy. It I don't even know when it's from, but it looks like Sonic Adventure era Sonic, and he's got a snowboard, and he found that toy again, and then has been into Sonic. It is, and also, my wife got him a very cute Sonic sweatshirt. And then when we were on vacation, I was at like stand at this resort, and there's like a pizzeria on site that we were just going in to pick up dinner one night. And I walk in, and there's some girl, probably like, I don't know, like could have been like, you know, somewhere early 20s, something like that, just goes like, nice shirt. And I was wearing a Zelda shirt. So there was like a thing where I was like, oh, is that to me? And then I looked at the girl and I was like, oh no, it's to my boy's Sonic shirt. I know your kind. but then like she was like super sweet, where she came over and like talked to my son just about like, oh, like, did you know there's a third movie coming out? It's in 2024. To which my son was just like, what? And I'm like, yeah, like you'll be a lot older than we could probably go in theaters. It's like I have known this information. I've been hiding it from you, kid, because I know that there's no use in telling you that a movie that you want to see is coming out in 2.5 years.
Right.
Or I guess a year and a, is it? No, 2.5 years. I had to think about the passage of time for a minute. But like, yeah, I mean, he was already enjoying wearing that sweatshirt before, but I think the fact that someone came up to him was like, you like Sonic? I do too. Has definitely emboldened him.
What does your son think about Shadow the Hedgehog?
He gets really stoked whenever we get to the post-credits scene in Sonic 2. Spoilers, I guess. And I don't know how he knows that it's Shadow. He calls Shadow the Hedgehog Shadow Sonic. I never told him this. I don't know where he learned it.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm gonna somehow blame I don't know. I'll blame Matt.
Probably.
Yeah.
I think Matt likes Shadow a lot.
But yeah, and like I actually did get the crappy Sonic game that came out the other. It was like $10 on sale, but we haven't played that yet. But we have played like Sonic Origins, as buggy as it is. And he's really been into Mario and Sonic at the Olympic Games, which, honestly, that game's not bad. It was pretty fun.
Can you do me a favor? Can you send me your my character from Sonic Forces and your son's?
When we get to it, I will.
Okay. Cool. I want to see which one of you has the gamer hat.
I'm actually like in a this game is going to be terrible, but I'll probably laugh a lot because I'll be playing it with my kid. I'm looking forward to playing Sonic Forces at some point. And honestly, just because of the fact that like my wife got really into Breath of the Wild, and I don't think Sonic Frontiers looks good, but it seems like from the perspective of I will enjoy this being a thing that is like a Stockholm Syndrome part of my life because of my child. I think I will have fun with it.
About that game for sure. I don't want to play it. I just want to see like other people experience it.
Maybe I'll get my kid to just like relay me some thoughts about like, what do you want the world to know about this video game?
Yes.
Eventually that seal is going to be broken when that kid starts doing reviews here. trying to keep that Pandora's box in as long as I can. He's helped in the past. Parkasaurus. This is a pretty cool Switch eShop game. I recommend it. So does my kid.
Is your son conscious like that you own and run a website that covers video games?
I did point out to him in a Target when the Pokemon Legends Arceus accolades video came up that I was like, that's me. And he just stared at me blankly.
He has no idea what's going on.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that like I've talked about people with, where I'm like, is he gonna think this is cool? He's like, no, he's just gonna think this is normal.
Yeah,
he's gonna find it weird. But it's like, what, your dad doesn't own a video game website too?
He doesn't get early codes.
you mean that was like Bowser's Fury. Like that's the thing. Like I mean that mother, like, he was definitely way too young to really realize that. But I was like, with Bowser's Fury, like it was just like, this is kind of neat that like my 2-year-old. It's playing this game like 2 weeks before it came out.
Yeah. Your son played it before Justin did.
but so, like, honestly, like, I'm unless I hear that Sonic Frontiers is like incomprehensible trash. I'm excited to play it. I don't think it's going to be good. It'd be really cool if it was. Like, I hope there is like an earnest like conversation of like Sonic Frontiers might actually be good. That would be a fun thing to happen. Or what we call in the biz, the anti-Balan Wonderworld.
I'm living in a win-win situation here where, like, if it's bad, then I will enjoy the content that oozes out of the Sonic Frontiers trash fire. But if it's good, then, like, yeah, that's great. I would love more games that, like, look and feel and play like Breath of the Wild to do well.
And be better than Immortals, which
I did not like.
I thought about that. I think that was on like a deep, because Ubisoft games just basically cycle on what one's on a deep sale on Switch. And I thought about it. Because I wanted to like Immortals, but I think they had, I think it was like, did they have like a free Stadia demo or something? Because I think that was when I got like my free Stadia controller from Verizon. And I think I played through the Immortals demo and was like, this sucks. Like, I never want to play this again.
I've thought about it multiple times, but I know that I'll just like pick it up and maybe play a couple hours and put it away. I'm waiting for the Epic Game Store like freebie version of that game to come out.
Yeah, or like have it go up on Game Pass or something.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's one of those things, like I look at a game like that and I'm just like, I mean, I could just replay Breath of the Wild.
Oh yeah, I'm already like planning on playing Breath of the Wild. Obviously, we're doing it for the Game Club, but yeah. I've already have an idea of like what I want to do when I go back to it.
Yeah. Like I played it back for review, and I've had two other attempts at a replay. One where because I went for Breath of the Wild initially, I kind of did what I believe is the critical path. And fight me if you disagree with me. It's going to Kakariko, and then from there, like going Zora. Zora is the it's very deliberately designed that like this is the way you should go. But there are points where, like, then after Zora, you're probably going to go to Goron because that's the closest. But you could also be like, oh no, I'm going to go over here. But like, path of least resistance is to do this chain of events.
I think I went Zora, Rito, Gerudo, then Goron.
Okay, yeah. That's, I mean, I think that Zora one is the one point that I would like. That seems purposeful. After that, it gets fuzzy. But my second playthrough, I went to Rito first because I wanted to get the power up that you get for that, of being able to just like pop up in the air.
Revali's Gale? Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then my most recent playthrough, which I didn't do for that long, I wound up just exploring everywhere except for progressing the divine beasts. Like, I think I had like 40 shrines of not actually going to any of the towns.
That game is like my favorite game of all time, and yet I still haven't beaten the Champions Ballad DLC for it.
Well, I had the issue where I lost my initial save, so I watched my wife play through that, because that's what happened. Is that because of my I referenced it when we talked about Splatoon the other week, because I also lost my Splatoon 2 save, but I lost my Breath of the Wild save, like my launch one, with like 70, 80, maybe 100 hours into it. So
how do you lose a Switch save?
Because my Switch died.
And you can't, was there, and no,
this
like
was 2017.
Cloud save? Oh no. Yeah,
so it was pre-cloud saves. And even, I mean, my Splatoon 2 save was screwed regardless, because that game does not have cloud saves. But yeah, so I lost, like, there's like things that, like, games that I was halfway through that I'm just like, oh, I'm not going back. Like, that actually stifled my Mario and Rabbids playthrough, because I like put a couple hours into it and my Switch died. It's like, damn it.
Should go back to it.
That's one where usually it gets distracted by the kid, but yeah. I really want to play that Donkey Kong DLC, because I've heard that's very good.
Yeah, I got that recently for like $5.
Yep, that's what I wound up. I have the game, and it was cheaper to just buy the gold edition as opposed to buying the DLC separately.
Nice. Yeah, those Ubisoft sales are very nice.
Yeah. Anything else from
Gamescom?
Gamescom. Dorf Romantic. That's a game that everybody says Dorf Romantic's really cool. It's coming to Switch at the end of September, and I will play it because it does look very cool. A very chill, like, city building game. Sounds fun. It
says tile-based strategy in the news article.
Yeah.
But it's not. Yeah.
Tiny strategy.
What's the strategic element?
It's probably the way that you place the tiles. to make your town or village or something. That is like I'm trying to think of a comparable game where it's just that, like, I have purposefully not looked that much into it. I just heard the name and people were like, it's incredible. And I'm like, okay, when it comes to Switch, I'll pay attention. And sure enough, it's coming to Switch. It's like Slay the Spire. That was mm-hmm. one where like people were like, this game's like the truth. And I'm like, all right, when it comes to Switch, I'll pay attention.
It and is. It's hard, but it's just pretty hard.
Yeah, no, that game is the truth. I think it's one. I think it's the best deck building roguelike of all time. And I don't think anything will ever top it. It is very hard. I've never beaten it. I think I made it. Was there like three? I think there's like three levels in that. And I think I made it to the third level with one of the characters once and felt very good about myself.
Okay, so this is like very European aesthetic plus the tiles makes me think this is like a Catan kind of game.
Yeah, it gives me Carcassonne vibes, which delights me.
Not played Carcassonne.
If you ever come to Jersey, because I'm not bringing the big box with me down to Texas, you should play some Carcassonne. It's a fun game.
Cool. As far as other Gamescom stuff, the only thing that really stood out to me was another tabletop-inspired kind of game, Moonbreaker, mostly because it's like a strategy kind of like tactical game, and it's being written by Brandon Sanderson. And I'm not sure if any of these, like, because this happened quite a few times where they'll bring in a fantasy author to.
And it happened literally this year with George R. R. Martin.
On
Elden Ring.
It's like how much of that influence really ends up in the final product. I'm not sure, but I am interested enough to pay attention and like put it on my Steam wish list.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that game looks super neat. It's being developed by Unknown Worlds, who did Subnautica, which those games came to Switch. Was that like a year or two ago? But yeah, I mean, Moonbreaker looks super cool. One, like, I think it has a lot of interesting things going on with it that will make me pay attention. Like the Brandon Sanderson thing, like, I don't know how that'll pan out, but it's interesting. That lore could be really cool. Maybe the story's really good. I don't know. But it does like the cute like miniatures that you paint in the game and then you use them for like goofy battles, and how there is a lot of. There was the talk because I watched the Keighley presentation where the director came out and like made the comment about like you're kind of putting your team together and like everybody's super unique.
Yeah.
Everybody's very distinct. And like I think there was, I forget what the exact comment was, but it was something about just like how like each one of these characters, if used the right way, could break the game. And it's a lot of that talk like that seems really fun. Like if they execute on that idea. And it's also just like the fact that like how customizable it is and that like you paint this. It's just taking a lot of the really cool elements of playing with miniatures, which is something that I've like dabbled in, but never gone full bore. And it is not the hobby that I can get into. I have bad fine motor skills, but I really like the style of that game. And hopefully it'll come to something that I think it's like coming to Steam Early Access very, very soon. And by the time it comes to Steam Early Access, I might have a Steam Deck. So maybe I'll just be playing Moonbreaker on my Steam Deck when it comes
out. Hopefully it runs on that.
Yeah.
If it comes to Switch, I demand touchscreen support.
I mean, it's something that like, yeah, I'm going to keep an eye on this. And realizing that. So with the Steam Deck, like I pre-ordered it humorously. If you follow me on Twitter sometime in June, I think I made some comment about how like, the Steam Deck is way more expensive than the Switch and blah, 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 blah. And then I was like, I should throw down a pre-order for Steam Deck. So I did back in June expecting that like, okay, I'll get this sometime in 2023. And then Valve like a month or so ago was like, oh, like we're going to be able to ramp up production. And I like, according to some of like the fan made charts using a lot of data, I might get mine in September or October. It's kind of seeing how well their production pipeline goes. I'm in a group that I will definitely have it by the end of the year, but it might be a lot sooner than that.
Meanwhile, I'm still waiting on my Analog Pocket that I ordered in December.
Oh, do they have a timeline for that or?
Q4 is when my group's supposed to get it.
Yeah,
that's and around the corner.
I love my Analog Pocket and I got an Analog Super NT the other year too. That company seems like a pain in the ass to deal with when it comes to pre-orders.
Yeah. And they're just very light on communication.
Yeah. Like that's what, like I had that and the Playdate kind of going with pre-orders at the same time. And The Playdate communications were twee as fuck. Which, that's what the Playdate is.
Yeah.
But like, they were like very clear as to like, here's why this got delayed. Like, we're not going to promise an exact time frame until we have an exact time frame, or like, because I know, like, I think it was supposed to be out by the end of the year, but then they had like this battery issue where like the batteries, I think, were like expanding or something like that. But they were very clear about like, we would have been ready in time, but and I just appreciated that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Analog is just kind of like, eh, soon.
Yeah, no, that's once, like, when they hear from God and the prophet comes down from the high tower in order to tell you that you have an update on when your Analog Pocket's supposed to come in. It's I've had like notifications set on for Analog Pocket just so I know for Analog's Twitter, just so that I know like if they do say anything. And most of the time it's just them posting GIFs of games. Yeah, Gamescom, I guess it, you know, kind of neat, but
it's happening.
It's the Venn diagram of like things that I care about and the stuff that gets shown off at Gamescom, or that really the stuff that gets shown off at like Keeley's presentation is just,
yeah,
not really.
No, like it was partially because I was, I'm a Nintendo fan hungry for a direct, but like I was kind of excited for the Summer Games Fest, like the Summer Games Fest kickoff or whatever the fuck it is. I was kind of excited for that, and like I just like as it went on, and it's weird because I do look at that and that like there are things that were announced in that, like Neon White's one of my favorite games of the year, so is the Turtles game. They both got release dates at that, but it, like I think what I think the one in June was like 3 hours long. Yeah. Like I probably cared about 20 minutes of it. And like I am glad that when I am paying attention to these, it's usually like I'm doing something else and it's just in another screen. Because if I was just like, I just think about how they were charging $20 to go see the Keeley Summer Games Fest thing in IMAX theaters, I would have rioted. If I went and was like, that's it? There were 4 space games in a row. I can't even tell you what
they're Dwayne The Rock Johnson talk about Black Adam and Zoe Energy for 5 minutes.
Yeah, on his camera phone. Like
on IMAX. I mean, I wish I paid for the $20 to see that.
Yeah, I would have laughed. I thought about it, but I'm glad I didn't. Just more for the like the experience of it. Because I thought it was gonna be like Sony's done stuff like that where you can just like get a free ticket because it's marketing.
Mm-hmm.
But even though Keeley's dad is like the president of IMAX, couldn't do that for free. But yeah, I think that's Gamescom. We do have that's one Gamescom. Thing of a by the time you hear this, it will have already happened, but Nintendo does have a Treehouse Live, 2 segments on Splatoon 3 of a single player segment and then a multiplayer segment for the Splatfest demo on Saturday, and then some stuff on Harvestella, the Square Enix attempt at Rune Factory, which I'm actually curious to see the Harvestella stuff because I really don't know what to think of that game.
Yeah, no, I want to watch that Treehouse. I really want a demo because I'm not sure if I want to commit to playing it, but yeah. I do want to kind of like just see how it plays compared to Rune Factory 5, a game I infamously hate.
And I was gonna say, especially you, I would feel very, very sus about a game that's like it's like Rune Factory.
Well. I don't hate the idea. I just the execution was.
I think that from what I've seen of Rune Factory 5, it seems like they had a hard time making that game.
I bet. Yeah. No. It kind of does feel like a game made by a not mobile market, but like a handheld market dev team working on what's supposed to be somewhat of a double A console release.
Yep. But yeah, I hope Harvestella is cool. Like, I'm looking forward to that part probably more than the Splatoon things.
Though, if it is, like, really, really good, I'd almost feel bad for Marvelous because it's Square just absolutely stealing your thunder. Because it is so much like, at least from the description, it is so much like Rune Factory.
Yeah.
Down to how the seasons work and everything.
Yep. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Are you going to play the Splatoon Splatfest on Saturday?
Hopefully, I will be streaming it. That's the idea, at least. We're kind of working around my schedule because I have something going on that evening, but we might be able to play some in the morning if we can do a different region.
Cool.
morning or early afternoon. Yeah, that might be the most I ever play Splatoon 3. We'll see.
We had our preview go up. Adam Abu Nasser, formerly a host on Connectivity, thankfully, because it happened to be when I was away. I think Matt couldn't get out of work from our New York area contingent of NWR people. Unfortunately, Jared lives in California now. He was our guy in the city. But yeah, Adam went to the demo, and I mean his preview's fine. He did send a note along pretty sentence for editing, being like, I feel nothing. I want to be proven wrong, but it just seems like a very by the book sequel. And that might be a very good game. I just don't know if I want to play it. And I mean, the last episode of the show, we talked about this at length because it was freshly off the direct. But just thinking about over the next 2 weeks, like, I believe my comment on that episode was, I'm still going to buy it anyway. And especially after, you know, seeing what came out of that demo and seeing like, okay, yeah, there wasn't really any surprises. I'm now just sitting here like, do I even, because I'm not going to, where I'm at in my life, I'm probably not going to play this online as much as I would have Splatoon 1 or 2. The single player seems like diminishing returns. I do really like Salmon Run, but unless like I've got a couple people to play Salmon Run with, I'm not going to play it.
Yeah, that's, I feel very similar. If there was like a large contingent of people at NWR who are very hyped to play this game and play it together, I would probably be on board because I think Splatoon is a very fun concept. But if it's just running off of my personal hype for this game, then it's not going to last. So yeah. I might skip. But I'm very curious to see how the demo plays out on Saturday.
Yeah. I like maybe it'll rekindle something.
Yeah.
And like I'll get back into it because like, I think about like the Splatoon 1 and even the like the first month or two of Splatoon 2, like that was electric. Like it's one of those things where like there's every now and then you play a game and you're like, oh God, this is the future. And I remember like playing Splatoon 1 and feeling that and like how that game felt. And unfortunately, they basically made the same game 3 times.
Yeah.
We do have some listener mail about Splatoon to brighten your day.
Later.
Cherry Goblin says, hey, Connectivity. One thing you didn't discuss from the direct is the new idol group for the game, Deep Cut. What are your thoughts on their designs? Is Big Man the new goat? To be honest, Fry's design startled me at first. Regarding hype for Splatoon 3, I am ready to dip back into this universe and see what is added to the lore. Get it? Dip is dipping into ink. I'll see myself out. Thanks and keep up the good work.
Nice pun there. What do you think about idols, Neil?
I don't care. it's the kind of, because what is Callie and Marie for the first two, and yep. then
Marina and Pearl from
yeah
Off the Hook,
and now we have Shiver and oh my God, it
was Fry just, and Big Man.
Yeah, I do like Big Man. Like the Big Man swerve is probably where they don't lose me.
And but, I do like the wrinkle that it adds to Splatfest, where it's now there's 3 options.
Yep.
I do appreciate that.
Which that is, I'm excited to see how that plays out in the Splatfest, which I think I'm going to try to at least hop in for a little bit. It depends on what my Saturday is. I hate that it's only one day. It'd be cool if that was like the full weekend.
Yeah.
But
rock, paper, or scissors? What are you going with?
I have not. I should make that decision because you can like go in now and do it, right? And like pick your side.
My heart just tells me to pick whatever Big Man says.
Yeah, maybe I'll just go with Big Man. Big Man will be my man.
I don't really care for like idol culture in the real world, so I've never really cared for the idols in Splatoon. If anything, they are annoying because you have to sit through their presentations every time you boot up the game.
But that's gone. So, in Splatoon 3, that's gone.
Yeah.
Like, I'm stoked. I don't want to hear them anymore.
Yeah, and I'll agree, like, Fry's forehead is, like, really weird. But, like, if I don't have to look at it and I can just play the game, then maybe Deep Cut's the best version of idols.
Like, Big Man is great. Like, give me the Big Man amiibo.
Oh. I told myself I would never collect amiibo ever again, but maybe if they release Big Man,
you have to make Big Man like the size of like Detective Pikachu.
No, exactly. It has to be like the Zelda Skyward Sword amiibo, yeah, where it's like extra big.
I mean, he is big man after all.
He is big man. Biggest of men.
So that might be about it. Some other things, but we went on for a lot longer on other topics than we expected. So maybe we'll just move in to close this out. If you don't want any spoilers on Xenoblade 3 through Chapter 4, nice seeing you. Because then Alex and I are going to talk about Xenoblade 3. We're both in Chapter 4.
Yay, new bonus Xenoblade segment. Let's go!
But before we get there, if you want to write in other listener mail, send an email to connectivity@nintendoreport.com. You can hit us up on Twitter @connectivitynwr. Thank you very much for listening. And next week, I don't know, we'll do something. We need to set a Wind Waker HD date at some point. It'll probably be in late September. I don't think anybody's playing it.
We're all playing Xenoblade 3.
Yeah, we're all playing Xenoblade 3. Or I don't know what John's excuse is. He should be done with Xenoblade 3 now.
I think he's playing Pac-Man right now.
Yeah, he is playing Pac-Man, which, I mean, that's probably what we'll talk about next week. But until then, but I forget what the Splatoon things say.
Stay fresh.
Stay fresh.
This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.
Xenoblade time. This game is the truth.
It is incredible. It's so weird, like, because, you know, recalling everything that I've said on this podcast about Xenoblade 1, about the things that didn't hit it for me, Xenoblade 3, it's not fixing, but it's like it's giving me everything that I wanted out of Xenoblade 1, where I have meaty side quests that feel important, that give detail into the world and characters, and a combat system that's gives me a lot of control, where I can actually fight something that may be like several levels above me and still have a fighting chance if I think strategically and I go in with the right setup. Having the class system is just something that I am an absolute fan of. It kind of scratches the same itch as Bravely Default, where you will get new classes, and by leveling up those classes per character will unlock things that you can do with other classes, so you can have some synergy going on there. I am very much a fan of what they're doing with Xenoblade 3, especially in terms of combat and gameplay and exploration.
It feels like there's always something that I can do.
Yes.
It's like a variety of things, like, because there is, you know, you could critical path it, and I feel like if you critical path this game, you're missing out on some of the best parts of the game. I think like the hero quests are legitimately great, and mm-hmm. some of them are story critical. A lot of them aren't. I just think like that, like all the periphery stuff, like it fills in the themes of the world, which is a really, like, it's weird, because I do think with like Xenoblade 1, comparing it to that, is that like I think like Shulk's quest is more optimistic in nature, whereas in Xenoblade 3, it's like everything around you is just like dealing with the concept of death. And I've really liked that broad theming of the entire game, and that it's like a lot of ways of how people are dealing with this life cycle that they're in and breaking free of it, and hearing people's different reasons for why they're in the spot that they're in. Like, I really like that overall. I do think the narrative in general is like, eh, it's okay. I think it's kind of a little bit more, like, I feel like I'm just walking in a direction to walk to a direction at this point.
Yeah, it lacks the, like, that forward momentum that, like, Eye on the Prize that Shulk had for the entirety of the story in Xenoblade 1.
Like, I've been going to Sword March for 25 hours at this point.
Yes.
I forgot why I'm going. It's some dude in the beginning was like, go to Sword March.
And that's Van Damme where I'm going. Says you gotta go because he's old and old people are there, I guess.
You're like, it's the first time they ever saw an old. but like, I like, it's weird that, like, I would say Xenoblade 1, like, I love the main story, and that's probably my least favorite thing so far. It's not that the story's bad, it's just that, like, I think it's maybe told a little clumsily. Some of the cutscenes are way too long.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been some impactful moments. And then going to, like, the combat and the gameplay, it's very much similar combat to Xenoblade 2, but the gacha crap is gone. And I love being able to fiddle with the different things. And what I like most about it is that if you don't want to fiddle with gems or specific arts to assign, you don't have to, and you're fine.
Just press Y.
Yeah, just press
Y. Autofill.
Yeah. And you won't have the, you know, the minute customization, which if you're not, I think we're both in a spot where we're a little over level. Like, I think I'm 45 or 46, and probably, like, the recommended level for what I'm doing is like mid to high 30s.
Yeah, I think we're in the very similar spot.
Yeah.
I'm level 44 and probably the very same area. So
yeah. Yeah.
I don't need to worry about customization. I just.
But it's also like, I'm not. And I've had moments where I've had tough boss fights, like they're either earlier in the game or with some of the elites, the elite unique enemies that I've come across. And those fights are really thrilling. But I also view it, and I think it's something that is just the way I am with RPGs at this point, is I would much rather, it's probably part of the reason why I love Paper Mario the Origami King, is because the light bulb that I had with Origami King is that battles are kind of pointless, except for the good ones. And a similar light bulb that I had with, say, Final Fantasy VII is that the battles in that game are also pointless, except for the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some of the boss fights, like, yeah, they rule in Final Fantasy VII, they rule in Origami King. Those moment to moment, like, in Final Fantasy VII, like, I'm just mashing buttons to get through random battles. In Origami King, it's a little more complicated because, you know, you're dealing with a ring system, and in Xenoblade, it's, you know, I mean, Xenoblade's also a very passive, like, random, they're not random encounters, you see them, but, like, your regular battles are usually pretty passive unless you're going against high level enemies.
Yeah.
And I kind of like being at a level where I don't draw aggro from any of the areas that I'm running around.
Yeah.
Because then it lets me explore, and it lets me focus on making the times when I do battle more impactful, because I'm not getting bored of the combat system, which is not my favorite combat system in a video game, but it's fine.
I enjoy it. It's definitely my favorite version of, well, I guess I played a little bit of 2.
I can hear an argument for 2's being better.
Really?
And that is coming from someone who does not like 2.
I really like classes. There's something about leveling up a class and then having that synergize with another class that really scratches an itch for me.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, it is really no knock against Xenoblade 3, and I think I ultimately prefer it, but I'm just saying I can, in a lot of the crap that I've slung at Xenoblade 2 over the years, I could actually hear someone being like, oh, no, I actually like the combat in this game more than Xenoblade 3. But what I love about Xenoblade 3 is that once you learn the language and rhythm of the game, the fact that there's 7 playable characters on the screen at one time isn't actually that confusing. Like, I have an awareness of what each character is, mm-hmm. what they're doing. Like, oh, like, that healer's not in a good spot. I got to go bring my defender over there. Or, like, for this specific battle, maybe I'm going to control the healer so that way I can make sure that the healer doesn't die. And then I'm around for, like, okay, like, this defender is going to get killed. I'm going to have the healer at the ready to go over there and get them back up. I find some of that moment-to-moment strategy really, really good. And I definitely do get into rhythm where like I'll just play one character with their current class, but then I'll get into a tough battle and find myself switching between a couple.
Yeah, I'll put them back in. Like, there was one battle where I didn't have enough defenders. Like, it was just everybody was either a healer or an attacker, and that's great when you're just mashing through low level enemies. But for harder boss battles, you definitely want those defenders, and like just making those quick changes, I was able to deal with a really high level boss. And it's really great to like when you get into those intense moments where everybody's on the verge of dying, but then you switch to an Ouroboros and keep yourself alive for a little bit longer, then you switch out and then you do a chain link a chain attack that does like over half the health worth of damage and absolutely slaughters a boss. It feels really, really good, especially when you get the hang of those chain attacks.
Yeah, that was definitely like a light bulb moment to actually figuring out the chain attacks and how to best deploy them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good game, and I mean, we were talking about it before the show where there's that part of me that just wants to get to the end, but I'm just having such a good time living in this world.
Yeah,
I have no real rush to blow through this game other than like it'd be fun to talk about it in more detail with, you know, John, Matt, and Jordan when the time comes.
Right. And I agree with you that the narrative isn't fantastic, but I do enjoy spending so much time with the characters and having like those discussion moments or the stuff at camp where it feels like almost a better version of Final Fantasy 15, a game that I didn't love. In fact, I really dislike a lot of Final Fantasy 15.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan. I've tried multiple times,
but I like the idea of like it's a road trip game where like a lot of the downtime you get to spend with characters, and Xenoblade 3 does that quite a bit too, where you'll have like discussions or just like the little animations at camp are really cute, and the game really spends a lot of time on the characters that are not Noah or Mio, and like coming off of Xenoblade 1 where it was kind of the Shulk show for most of it, that feels pretty nice.
Did you wind up reading the interviews that Nintendo put out around the launch?
I did not. I think I was really into Xenoblade 1 at the moment. I didn't want to like spoil too much of Xenoblade 3.
So like it's too much of it. As I've been playing through this game, I've been thinking about some of the responses there, because one of them was about like they had the six characters and one of them on screen at the same time, largely because like it felt incongruous with the story when they would have moments like in Xenoblade 1 where you'd only have three characters running around and then have a cutscene where the other ones would show up, which like I do kind of like that is like that's the part of the reasoning why they had six characters on screen at one time. And then with that as well is they're like, yeah, like Noah and Mio are the two main characters, but they wanted to like make sure everybody else had their time to shine. And I remember raising an eyebrow when I read that, and I'm playing the game and I'm like, they're actually kind of doing it. Like, I just like early on, I'm like, oh, Teon sucks. And then you get to some of the, I mean, and this is core story stuff. This isn't even side stuff. Like already, like he's had like you've learned more about this character. Like they're not afraid to spend too much time on like, all right, let's go and do this character's backstory now. And from what I've heard about, so like when you get the classes at the rank 10, then there's also like the ascension quests that get them up to rank 20 that I think unlock in like chapter 5 or something. Like when those hit, apparently those like side stories deepen the specific characters even more, both from when you do the six main characters classes at the outset, when you do the back half of those, you'll get more details on them. And then even for the heroes, their ascension quests will give you more, like basically, you know, the hero quest was the first part of their story, and then this is the next part of the conclusion. And I just love how much it fills out the world. Like the lore in this game is crazy. I'm really digging it.
Yep. I'm right there with you. It's a very, very, very good game. Yeah.
So we'll see you guys next week when we're probably still in chapter 4.
Yeah. I told myself I'd try and do more story, but I'm doing a bunch of Colony 11 side quests right now.
Yeah, no, which I'll once I get to a point where I have a fast travel point to where I'm at in the story, then I'm going to go back and clean up some of the side quests. I have regrets about playing through the story, so I think you made the right decision.
Cool.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.